Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
Well, once upon a time, President Kennedy liked to say that a rising tide lifts all boats. But over the past decade, at least, that metaphor has repeatedly been proven wrong, at least when it comes to African-American men. Consider these statistics. More black male high school dropouts today are in prison than have jobs. And even during the go-go 1990s, the black male jobless rate grew, even as unemployment dropped among whites, Hispanics, and women. A number of recent studies, highlighted in the New York Times yesterday, point to the dim prospects of young black men entering the workforce or re-entering the workforce after spending time in jail. And we'll talk this morning about this tremendous problem that gets very little attention day to day, even though, as one of my guests will say, black men are already the most studied or overstudied demographic in America. My guests are Walter Fields, Vice President for Political Development at the Community Service Society of New York, which studies and advocates around issues of poverty in the city, and Ronald Mincy, a professor of social policy and social work practice at the Columbia University School of Social Work. He's also the editor of a new book, one of the books referenced in the Times article yesterday, Black Males Left Behind, published by the Urban Institute Press. Thanks to both of you for coming on WNYC today. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Professor Mincy, give us a little statistical profile, if you will, of just what we're talking about. What are some of the most troubling statistics, some of the most important statistics that you found in putting together your new study, Black Males Left Behind?
Well, I think the most important finding is we had two decades of consistent economic growth from 1979 to 2000. That interrupted by just a few brief recessions. And despite that period of unprecedented economic growth, the employment rates of young black men who had not gone on to college fell continuously. So, again, almost every other demographic group, including women with who had not gone on to college, experienced increases in employment, increases in their earnings. We also saw dramatic drops in the welfare rolls. But for a set of reasons, black men just did not respond to these unprecedentedly good economic times.
And Walter Fields, two of the particular trends highlighted by charts in the Times article are very telling about the prospects for perhaps anybody who doesn't have a sufficient education these days. Jobless rates among male high school dropouts ages 22 to 30 is one of the stats, and it's much worse for blacks than for anyone else, but even for whites it went up from 25% jobless to 34% jobless from 1980 to 2000 if they dropped out of high school. For blacks, it went up from 43% jobless in 1980 to 72% jobless by the year 2000 if they were high school dropouts. So an indication that you really need an education more than ever before.
Without a doubt, in a knowledge-based economy that is often dependent upon technology today and also services, we're finding many young black men are just not capable of entering into the labor market. And one of the things we found in New York through our own research, we found that upwards of 50% of all black men are jobless, which is a striking number when you begin to think about how many people that actually is. I think one of the things that all of the research points to is a need to rethink how we go about planning interventions for this population, that we probably need to start looking at some very strategic and targeted interventions, because this problem is not new. I mean, we've been looking at this for 20-some-odd years. The New York Times article talks about Baltimore, and I can recall being in Baltimore in the early 1980s when the crack epidemic hit. The fact of the matter is that many of these communities have been devastated now upwards to 30 years. And what we've got to do is find a way to redirect public dollars, public investments in programs that I think are more locally rooted, so that we begin to start the process, at least, of addressing some of these long-term issues.
And Dr. Mincy, again, to pull out another of these charts from the Times article, even among people who presumably finished high school but did not attend college, listen to how troubling these numbers are, and you probably know, and how different, again, for black men. This is the jobless rate among males who did not attend college, ages 22 to 30. And in that same time period of 1980 to 2000, it went up for white men from 16% to 21%. That is 21% of those who did not attend college without jobs. For black men, it went up from a third to a half. So it was 34% of black men who did not attend college in 1980 were jobless by the age of 30, fully half by the year 2000 who were in that group. And that's a truly frightening statistic.
It is. And I think it sort of redefines what we are thinking about in terms of playing by the rules. So the real question is, for black men at least, the basic rules include having gone on to college, because if they don't, half of them are going to be unemployed. And I couldn't agree with you more that we really have to redefine in a way what really are our objectives for this population, and secondly, to understand better how we're going to get there. And I think the other troubling experience of the 1980s, or really the good news of the 1980s and 1990s especially, is that when we combine public policies directed toward low-skilled women, the same women who are the mothers of the children fathered by these men, we were able to achieve substantial employment increases, substantial reductions in welfare rolls without, and I want to emphasize that, without a lot of investment in their education. Now, I'm not arguing that we don't need to do more investment in education and going to college and the like, but we have to combine a strong economy with a set of public policies that are uniquely designed to the needs of this population, and we haven't.
And Walter Fields, what about the difference between black men and Hispanic men, as noted in these same two charts? I wonder how much you see this holding true for New York. Maybe the difference is even more striking than between whites and blacks, because there was basically no change over those 20-year periods in the jobless rate among Hispanics who were either high school dropouts or didn't attend college. And it was a very low unemployment rate, the lowest of the three, under 20%, and with basically no change, 18-19% over that 20-year period, compared to whites who dropped out of college having a 34% unemployment rate, whites who didn't go to college having a 21% employment rate, blacks 50%, Hispanics 19%. What do you make of that?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint the exact factors, but I think, of course, race is an issue in all of this. And I think when you start looking at the cycle of incarceration, I mean, one of the real challenges we have here is the rates of incarceration of black men. And until we begin to address that issue, we're going to always come back to this point in this discussion. We're finding in places like New York, where you have 10 or 12 zip codes, where overwhelmingly 70% of all individuals released from correctional facilities return to those neighborhoods. How do we begin to repair those communities so that large numbers of black men who are coming home have an opportunity, have a means to support themselves and their families? Is one of the things that David Jones, the CEO of the Community Service Society, is keenly interested in. And we've actually teamed up with the Congressional Black Caucus. We're part of the State of the African American Male Initiative, which is a national initiative that looks at these type of issues. But I think when you begin to look at black men, there are a unique set of factors that have put them in this predicament.
I couldn't agree more that incarceration is critical, but it's not only critical to those who have been incarcerated. So one of the things that we find in the study that you mentioned is that even young black men who are less educated and live in the same communities, where the ex-offenders are returning to. Even their employment prospects are damaged by the fact that they have the same profile. So employers are much less likely to hire ex-offenders than they are other people with negative labor market experiences. But when it comes to black men, or they generally do not check, do not make employment background checks. So there's a profile, a less educated young black man from a given address, take his resume and throw it in the trash. So I think, again, some of this involves individual solutions. Some of this involves figuring out how to get control of this incarceration ex-offender cycling in and out. But some of this also requires dealing with the statistical discrimination that young black men face in large urban areas.
My guest on WNYC, Walter Fields, Vice President for Political Development at the Community Service Society of New York, and Ronald Mincy, Social Policy and Social Work Practice Professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work and editor of the new book, Black Males Left Behind, published by the Urban Institute Press. And we can take your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Talk about your experiences. Talk about the experiences of loved ones. Talk about the problem in general. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And obviously, from your answers, you're both very focused on not just identifying the problem, which in a way is not new at all. I think what we learned from these recent studies is it's resistance to change, but it's not new. You both want to focus on solutions and what to do next. And Professor Mincy, I think there was an old debate in this country that I think is dying out between racism and lack of investment in schools and the flight of manufacturing jobs and other external causes of the problem, and black inner city culture, family breakdown, gangster rap, studying mocked as acting white, that sort of thing, whatever. But I think I see a new consensus emerging which says basically all of the above. Do you think so?
I think that is absolutely right. And I think we definitely have to take a page out of the book for low-skill women in the 1980s. I mean, I really think that we have to redefine what our expectations are with respect to African-American men. What do we want? We want them to go to high school and to go on to college. And I think we have to begin to create a set of initiatives along the pipeline from elementary school on up to make sure that more of them are getting into college in the first place. And fortunately, in New York City, such an initiative is beginning to take place throughout the university system. We also want them to work. However, I also think that we've been vague about how much we want them to earn. I think in the case of low-income women, what we did was we spent $50 billion during the 1990s. And I can't emphasize that enough, an extraordinary amount, in part to do child care, Medicaid assistance, cash assistance, and the like. But we also created a $30 billion wage subsidy so that low-skill women who went to work could afford to feed their families.
What do you mean wage subsidy?
I mean that when a mother with two children goes to work and earns a low wage, we have an earned income tax credit that supplements her wage so that working pays more than welfare. Her brother or the father of her children has no such subsidy. So for him, he can go to work, he can make $9 an hour. However, after he finishes paying his child support, he's very likely to be poor. So part of the problem is they can't get jobs in the first place. But the other problem is their incentives to work are very low because they are not entitled to the same earning supplements that low-skill women are.
Walter Fields?
No, I think he's right. And I think you also have to look at this whole issue of, you know, if you're going to talk about creating sort of the broadest possible approach to tackle these issues, you really have to deal with things like the criminalization of black men. And it's not necessarily the criminalization in terms of incarceration, but this notion that somehow or another young black men are uneducable, that young black men cannot work effectively in the labor market. Unless we begin dealing with those type of perception issues, I think we're going to have a tough road to go, because one of the challenges facing black men, it starts at a very early age. When you look at all of the studies, we're losing black boys as early as third grade. There is something going on in terms of how black males are looked upon at an early point in their life that sets them up for failure.
We're going to continue in a minute. We'll start to take phone calls. I also want to continue on the question of education and see what you both think of programs like No Child Left Behind, which to some degree is targeted specifically at racial improvements, and Mayor Bloomberg's education reforms. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we talk about the rising tide of the 90s, not lifting all boats in the economy, the increasing falling behind of African-American men, according to a number of new studies, a number of them referred to in a front page New York Times article yesterday, which has become the most emailed article from the Times in the last day. And we're talking about this with one of the people quoted in the article, Ronald Mincy, a professor of social policy and social work practice at the Columbia University School of Social Work. He's editor of a new book called Black Males Left Behind, published by the Urban Institute Press. And Walter Fields, vice president for political development at the Community Service Society of New York. And we will go to the phones now. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Jose in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jose.
Hello. Yes, I was calling because I think the statistic always not real, not true. I came here as an immigrant, I'm Hispanic, and I came about 12 years ago. I went to college. First I learned English, then I went to college. And in the college, I saw that the opportunity is for everybody, the federal aid is for everybody. But most black people who were in my classes, they never pay attention to the classes. They were hanging around, talking to the cell phone when they were in classes. Well, of course, they never graduate. But not because not the chance is denied to them. It's just because they didn't want to do it.
Well, Walter Fields, it's not just white people who have this perception.
Well, you know, and it is a problem. And I think that's a popular myth that's put out there. Every year, thousands of black students graduate from colleges, historically black colleges, and, you know, white institutions of higher learning. We have a black middle class that has grown despite all of these issues. I think the larger issue becomes sort of the racial dynamics in this country and how black men have been displaced. And one of the things we have to get to is get beyond the myths and really begin to address the intrinsic problems that we face with this population. And we've tried to do that at the Community Service Society. Some of our research helped spawn a major workforce development program of the New York City Council, some $10 million that was allocated to begin looking at these issues. We were also very supportive and participated in Mayor Bloomberg's initiative around construction employment, because that's an industry where blacks, particularly men, have had a hard time to penetrate. But the problem when you hear these type of responses is that it lends credence to the notion that somehow or another blacks are lazy, that blacks don't want to succeed, that somehow or another our expectations and desires are somewhat different from other groups. And that's absolutely not true.
Professor Mincy, I know you've studied the decline in marriage rates among African Americans. What do you say to Jose, and how do you think that plays into young black men's difficulties?
Well, what the data show is that children, all children, and black male children in particular, who are raised in two-parent homes, are more likely to go on to college, more likely to be employed, more likely to have earnings and the like. So I think the caller, from the vantage point that he observed, might well have seen black students who are not taking advantage of the educational opportunities that were available to them. However, we're focusing on young people who've not gone on to college. And I think I have been concerned for decades on one of the reasons why black males have higher incarceration rates than other populations is because they're more likely to grow up without their fathers than black males in than other populations are. And so I really am concerned that coming from a two-parent home increases school readiness, it increases school performance, it increases the likelihood that you graduate, and the fact that 70% of African-American children are born to unmarried parents, which means that they are much less likely to experience the benefits of a father and mother over their lifetime. I think that is the beginning of the crux of the answer to this question.
Walter Fields, does the Community Service Society, or do you in your role deal with this? You're vice president for political development. Does that make you more oriented to look at problems of racism, problems of stereotyping, et cetera, and less focused on looking at behavioral issues?
I think we look at both. I think we're really focused now on trying to figure out some interventions on how you begin to solve some of these longstanding problems. And I think the issue of two-parent household is a significant and relevant issue. But, you know, but I will tell you, I grew up with a single mom because my dad died at an early age. And there was a network of black men in my community who were my extended family. And I think we're missing that also. There are certain, you know, intangibles that data doesn't necessarily capture, sort of those social networks that create opportunities. So I know coming home from college, when I was in college, I would have to check in with the older black men who I played basketball with because they would demand to see my grades. And it was sort of that accountability measure that we're also missing. So I think part of it is this notion of, yes, two-parent households, but we also have to rebuild the sort of the social fabric that existed for years in a black community that has been destroyed.
Well, I think, you know, part of what we're talking about is you know, how class intersects with race. I also grew up in a single parent home, but most of my friends, I grew up in a community mm-hmm. where most of the young men were from single parent homes. The social fabric that you speak of was just not available. Instead, they were just a community full of adolescents doing what adolescents do. So I think that we really do have to address both sides of this. There's an external part, what can the community, the outside society, what can government do? But I also think that we have to hold black people accountable in all this, and black men in particular. So, again, the more young black men who will grow up in two-parent families, the less likely we're going to see this problem occur over time. Some of this is an internal response that is a response that only we can take care of. Other parts of the response will have to look to help, to get help from external sources.
Let's take another call. Ed in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I think that a short way of reducing unemployment would be to reduce the amount of immigrants that come in to both the city and the country. Why? Because all one needs to do is walk around Manhattan and see that many low-skilled jobs or, shall we say, semi-skilled jobs that black men can do are peopled virtually entirely by immigrants. For example, doormen. Not a job where you need to be a high school graduate. Yet, if the super is from the former Yugoslavia, all he hires is his relatives or friends. If the individual is Hispanic, it works the same way. Plus, there's that element that the gentleman mentioned before, which is the stereotype that blacks don't work. I had a conversation with a super in a building where he said blacks are lazy, and it was the day after the Penn relays, and I said, you know, I was watching the Penn relays, and these guys didn't look lazy to me.
Right. All right, Ed. Thank you for your call. But let's go to the immigration question, and down even further on the job pecking order from doorman. You know, we have politicians of both parties right now, Walter Fields, pushing a guest worker program because they say we need the labor. There aren't the workers to do various unskilled jobs, a lot of urban unskilled jobs, not just working in the fields. And so one could look at the unemployment rate for unskilled black men and the fact that we're importing unskilled labor from other countries because there's a shortage and say, why is there a disconnect here?
Well, I think there's a real disconnect, and unfortunately, I think immigration is often a gasoline that's thrown on the fire. And I really get concerned when I hear people pitting, you know, this whole immigration debate against this issue, particularly when it comes to the black community and the loss of jobs, because I've never bought the displacement argument at all. I think that there are some unique set of circumstances that are affecting black men separate and apart from this notion of immigrants and jobs. And I think we need to stay focused and targeted in our approach. You know, and I do want to go back to something the professor said about, you know, accountability. I couldn't agree with him more in terms of there needs to be a discussion in the black community about how we go about raising young black boys and the responsibility of young black men to themselves and their families. Without a doubt, we need to do that. But I think that has to be done in a context of some of these other structural barriers that exist. Because even though you may have young black men who are accountable, some of the barriers they face are not of their own making. And I think the professor is absolutely right that we've got to look at both sides of the coin. But I want to make sure that we never forget that the two are interconnected.
But I also think that the experience of the 1990s does answer the immigration question. I mean, another flavor of it was that really women were taking jobs from men.
Exactly.
And the studies that we've undertaken indicate that in metropolitan areas where employment was growing rapidly, employment rates among less skilled women grew and employment rates among less skilled men grew. So these are not really competitors in the same labor market. I really think that that's a distraction. I don't think a solution to this is denying the opportunity that the United States offers to immigrants. I think, as my colleague mentioned, that there are some unique problems associated with African American men, and we need to attend to them.
But part of the rationale for the guest worker proposals is that there is unskilled labor needed in the cities that is not being applied for by any Americans. And so if we're looking at charts as the basis of this segment that say, you know, there's such a lack of unemployment among people who don't have, I mean, such a lack of employment among black men who don't have skills, and yet there's this unskilled labor out there that we're importing people for, does it mean African-American men without high school degrees, without college degrees, who've been in and out of prison, are not applying for jobs as, I don't know, dishwashers or construction workers or whatever, you know, day laborers or whatever it is these immigrants are doing?
I think that's part of the answer, and then the question is why. But I also think that when they apply, they're less likely to get the job. But let's talk about the solutions. Since the mid-1980s, I've been working with a program called Strive that's located on 123rd Street in Harlem. And what they do is essentially the kind of attitudinal assessments and changes in the attitudes and behaviors of young black men with respect to work, so that they do acknowledge their responsibilities, accept them, apply for lower wage jobs, and after working for a period of time, go back and get subsequent vocational training and go on to get jobs as computer operators, help desk operators, and end up making $20,000, $30,000 a year, including ex-offenders. So again, I think the guest worker program is a way of filling the supply of low-wage labor, but part of the low-wage labor that is not available are these young black men themselves. And I think if we can work with them to change their orientations around work, particularly work at low wages, they can fill part of that labor supply themselves.
Ronald Mincy from Columbia University's Social Work School, Walter Fields from the Community Service Society of New York, my guests on WNYC, and let's take another phone call. John in Midtown, you're on WNYC. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Hi. I'm fine. The problem that you're talking about, I think it's more deeply rooted than what the guests are talking about. Because, for instance, my case, I'm going to talk about my own experience. I am highly educated. I have a master's degree in computer sciences. And I have never been able to get a job since September 11th. I used to work at World Trade Center, and after that, the project I was working on just died with the attacks. And since then, I have been unable to get a job. Every interview I go to, you know, nobody ever calls back, and it's become a very big problem for me, whereby now I have to take small kind of jobs just to keep.
So you think there's a problem of racial discrimination even at your level?
Yes. I don't think it matters whether you have a college degree or you have a high school diploma or you don't. The bottom line is the moment you walk in and, you know, people see you're black, that's it. You know, it's never going to work.
John, I'm going to move on to another caller. Thank you for your call. This is, I believe, an Asbury Park city councilman, Jim.
Yes.
In Asbury Park, is that
yes.
right?
Yes. Good morning, Brian.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, I'm a councilman in the city of Asbury Park, New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
and I need help from the gentleman that you have on this morning. We are a city of 18,000 people, over 70% black. 75% of the juvenile crime in Monmouth County comes out of Asbury Park. We have 30% of our families are living below the poverty line, probably another 20% just teetering above it. The median household income is half of that of the county. We have a significantly high incarceration rate, particularly among young black men. And, you know, we've been trying to implement programs just in the last 6 months. We just allocated money for a youth jobs program. We've got another program that I just got a proposal for to help ex-offenders get back into the workforce. I just want to make sure that we're on the right track. And I think that Asbury could be a great place for these gentlemen to put some of their ideas into practice because it's manageable.
Professor Mincy, what do you say to the councilman from Asbury Park, and maybe also talk about particular success stories that he or others might use as models?
I would suggest that he give a call to public-private ventures and learn about a project called Ready to Work. It's a demonstration project that has, I think, 12 or 15 sites around the country that is working with ex-offenders, trying to help them establish mentor connections in the community to help them find jobs and to help them reintegrate into the community. They can also, he should also call the program I mentioned, Strive in New York. They also have an ex-offender program. And so there are models around the country where communities are learning from one another about how to help ex-offenders reconnect to their communities.
I think that's great advice, and I know in New York City, one of the real challenges we face with the reentry population, the formerly incarcerated, is the fact that in New York State, there are statutory prohibitions that actually deny employment opportunities to individuals returning from correctional facilities. And that's a big problem, the fact that you can't be licensed to be a barber or a plumber. There are a number of trades that you're locked out of. And I think that's some of the issues that we're beginning to examine at the Community Service Society is how do you eliminate those statutory barriers so that people will have the opportunity to work. Asbury, I'm very familiar with because I'm a New Jersey resident, and I think, you know, what you're facing there is what you're facing across the country in terms of the intersection with the criminal justice system. Somehow or another, we have to find a way to have a greater front-end investment in young black men, because what we're doing now is we're spending inordinate amount of money sort of creating a correctional culture.
We just have a minute left, and so what about the investments in education? What about the No Child Left Behind initiative at the federal level, and what Mayor Bloomberg is doing at the city level here in New York? Do they matter? Are they productive, counterproductive? What do you think, Walter?
I think only time will tell, particularly, you know, the problems we've had with No Child Left Behind. I think Mayor Bloomberg, to his credit, has used his political capital to try to arrest the New York City public school system, which is a big nut to crack. I think for young black men, though, there has to be a focused effort at the earliest ages. I think we have to look at preschool, federal level. I think we have to really look at expansion of Head Start. We've got to find ways to make sure that young black men are on a pathway to success at a very early point in their life.
And I think, you know, part of the strategy is I think we also have to look at the proposal from Robert Dorr, the Commissioner of Temporary and Disability Assistance in New York, to create earning subsidies for young men who have child support obligations. I think we also, again, have to look at, for New York, in terms of higher education, what's going on with the Black Male Initiative in New York City to help all along the pipeline. More third graders go on to fourth grade and graduate from elementary school to graduate from high school and to use this extraordinarily rich university system to educate.
And that's where we
black
have
men.
To leave it for today. Ronald Mincy, editor of Black Males Left Behind, Walter Fields, Vice President for Political Development at the Community Service Society. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.